Well, good morning to you all, and welcome to the sixth Kuwait breakfast on the theme of Islamic finance in the Gulf, boom and bust. Before I start, I would just mention one thing. I am the co-director of LSE Global Governance, a research center at the LSE, which houses the Kuwait program, and we've also just started a North Africa program, focusing particularly on Libya and its neighbors. But last week was notable for something else. We've launched a major new LSE initiative called Global Policy. It's a new journal. The world doesn't need a new journal, but surprisingly it does need this one because there isn't one that focuses on the major global issues of our time that brings together both academics and practitioner. It's modeled to some extent on nature. It's free for 2 years. So I'm not trying to sell you anything. If you go to globalpolicyjournal.com, one word, globalpolicyjournal.com, you can be prepared to be impressed. I think it is quite a significant intervention in public life. So let me start now by the matter in hand and introduce our two speakers, Ian Walker and George Morton. Ian Walker is director of the Arab Financial Forum and managing director of MEC International. He began his career as a political journalist before he moved to government relations and corporate strategy. He's been involved in the Middle East for the past decade and directs the Windsor Energy Group. This addresses energy geopolitics, global energy issues, and energy security. You should write for Global Politics, I should say, in the practitioner sections. The Arab International Forum provides a framework for strategic discussions on key issues facing the development of Arab financial markets. It does so by linking decision makers and opinion formers from the public and private sectors, both in the Arab world and their domestic counterparts. Its core areas of focus are development of capital markets, economic liberalization, integration of Islamic finance within conventional structures, and financial regulation. On my right, George Morton is chairman of the MEC International and a director of the European Islamic Investment Bank. He was raised in Canada and began his career in the Foreign Service of Canada before entering the Canadian banking system industry in 1972. After working in Thailand, Singapore, and London, his career turned towards the Arab world, where he's lived and worked for the last 20 years. From 82 to 91, he worked as a Gulf International Bank in Bahrain before spending 4 years as deputy general manager and head of banking of the National Bank of Bahrain. In 1995, he moved to the Arab Bank Corporation in Bahrain, where he spent 6 years as senior vice president and head of the international services. He's retired from banking in 2004 and currently holds a number of advisory and consultancy positions. That's the team, as it were. Good morning to you all. We start now and end at 9. Over to you.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. And I knew there's a reason for getting up this morning, and the breakfast is probably the best part of it. But thank you for coming. The title of the presentation I'd like to talk about is Boom and Bust in Gulf Islamic Finance. We've seen the boom. We've seen Dubai illustrating some of the potential bust potential. And I think the jury is still out on whether it's going to resume its upward course or not. But I'd like to touch on some of the issues, some of the trends, and hopefully get some feedback from some of you who are much closer to this issue than I am. So I'll sit down if I may. If you can't see me, just shout. I am here. One of the first things about Islamic finance, as we all know, is it's a very different way of looking at money. One of the experts on Islamic finance I know is an American lawyer, and he handled the first Islamic finance deal for a petrochemical plant in Saudi Arabia. And he told me he spent night after night sitting down with a very expert Sharia scholar. And, of course, he wouldn't offend the scholar by talking about petrochemical. So he said, I've got a camel, you've got a camel, and they come together, and it's Valentine's Day, and they have a baby camel. Now, who gets the slice of the baby camel, and who pays what for feeding the camel, and who pays for the vets in case the camel needs dealing? And this went on night after night. Until finally, at the end of this, he said, I've got an understanding of how Islamic finance works. And the Islamic scholar said, but why are we talking about camels? I thought it was a petrochemical plant. So sometimes I think we've got to be a little bit more open about what it is that we're talking about. But the camel is a good illustration of how to understand Islamic finance, which does constrain what we can do. The second big challenge is Sharia law itself. The Gulf, I'm afraid, has been a follower of Islamic finance. Saudi Arabia didn't allow Islamic finance some 20-odd years ago. The drive for it's tended to come out of the Muslim areas of Malaysia. And their interpretation of Sharia is much, much more liberal than what you find in the Gulf. So one of the big problems for Islamic finance is there's still no universal understanding of what is Sharia and what is not. The final point is what degree of impurity. I don't think Islamic finance anywhere in the world can claim to be pure, simply because of the to what extent do you drill down and say this company has shares or it's buying from some company or it's the purity required from Sharia just doesn't exist. So it's a question of degree of impurity that investors are happy to live with. The kind of the problem we're talking about, I mean, Sukuk, as you know, is one of the big capital investment bonds under Sharia. I mean, it's shot up dramatically. It was $8 billion in 2003, $100 billion in 2008. That's a massive rise by anyone's standard. The second thing we've seen in recent months, certainly just before Christmas, was the big wobble. Dubai, with its Sukuk and other bonds, has made people a little bit wary about how solid this kind of investment is. The fact that the Burj has been renamed after the ruler of Abu Dhabi rather than the Dubai shows you how this kind of investment has had to be bailed out elsewhere. And that is not Islamic finance, that's oil money from Abu Dhabi that's helped bail out Dubai on this occasion. The final point is about how Sukuk has rebounded. I mean, according to Bloomberg, the Sukuk sales have gone up to $20 billion last year from $14 billion in 2008. Global Sukuk issuance has gone up 40%. So it's still a market where people are happy to try the market and see if people buy into, and it does seem it's there. What are the trends that we see coming through? I mean, one of the very interesting areas, if you're sitting in the Gulf, your opportunity to invest locally is somewhat restricted. You've got relatively small stock markets. The stock markets have been don't have a good reputation for transparency, and low valuations are making IPOs unattractive. So Gulf investors see Sukuk and Islamic as another way of spreading their investment bet. And this is money coming out of oil revenues, of course. The private sector appetite is growing. GE have just had a very successful $500 million five-year issuance, and they're saying they're planning to become regular issues in the Sukuk market. Dubai, HSBC, Dubai Islamic Bank, and KFH Bahrain has also oversubscribed in a recent issue. Given that, there is competition coming through. Malaysia continues to be the pacemaker in terms of its both size and flexibility about what it's prepared to describe as Sharia. Thailand's also following this example, and I think with Indonesia, this part of the world is going to be the center for Islamic finance. And it might be that some of the Gulf Islamic investors will be looking there rather than in the Gulf itself. Malaysia accounted for something like half of global Sukuk sales in 2009, and Indonesia, of course, has got the world's largest Muslim population. Malaysia, as well, is quite happy to talk up the market. According to the Islamic Financial Services Board in Kuala Lumpur, they say that by 2015 that the market will have gone from $1 trillion in Islamic finance to $2.8 trillion. Now, that, again, is we'll see, but that's the kind of talk that's going on. So what are the problems ahead? One of the problems is there aren't many big transactions around on the marketplace, despite the size of growth I've been talking about. The even bigger problem is the lack of expertise. No organization or sector can grow so fast and manage to keep up with quality of people able to deliver and supply professional expertise. And the kind of numbers we're talking about, I'm afraid, does require professional expertise. The other surprising thing, I think, is some of the Islamic banks thought that they could export Islamic finance to some of the other parts of the world. And we had the UK led the way with the first Islamic retail bank supported by Gulf investors. They've made relatively little impression on the Muslim population in the UK. I mean, there's talk about them having 50,000 retail subscribers, but that's very little compared with the couple of million or so Islamic population we're talking about here. In fact, they're even talking about positioning themselves now as an ethical bank rather than an Islamic bank, because they're, and this is something I think that we'll hear about later. The other big question mark on Islamic finance, like a lot of Gulf finance, is lack of transparency. Nobody really knows how bad Islamic investors have suffered from the real estate slump. That's just one example. Because Islamic investment is focused on a few number of sectors, if one of those sectors takes a nosedive, then they're going to be very vulnerable. So there is a need for much more openness in terms of where these investments are going. The threats and opportunities ahead. I think we've all been watching commodity prices shoot up in terms of price of, well, not just energy, but metal prices, oil and gold. And people are blaming the Chinese for getting rid of their mountain of dollars and buying cheap while things are around, so they build stockpiles. But actually, Islamic finance is another player in that game, because commodity investment is one of the attractive areas under Sharia investment. So, again, is that going to be a bubble that could burst in the commodities area? In the same way, you see that Dubai has the world's biggest gold souk, and anyone who's been to it will be amazed by the range and extent of people buying and selling gold. It's not just from the Indian community, but from across the area. One of the opportunities, I think, is the opportunities that Islamic finance has for buying into treasury bills and bonds. At a time when Europe is Germany, France, Italy, Britain have these government bonds coming through. This is going to be very attractive potentially, and they'll be knocking on the door of some of the Islamic investors. So, the future. Who's chasing Islamic money? And as I said, Europe is definitely there. I mean, France needs something like 450 billion euro, Italy about 390, Germany 385 billion potentially bonds, and the UK in at 275. The growth of global Islamic population is another factor in Islamic finance. There are a lot more young Islamic people in the world, and they're going to be a market potentially for this process. The standardization is going to be a brake on this growth unless there can be a big investment in terms of training and commitment and understanding. And standardization in Sharia law is going to be the key to making this a success. Mainstreaming Islamic finance is another question mark. At the moment, it's all been relatively plain sailing with a buoyant market with Islamic investors taking big ticket shares. But when those deals go wrong, where is the legal framework? What kind of international law applies to Sharia? These are some of the unknown question marks that will come out as and when there are downturns and problems within sectors. One interesting area I think that we'll see is a growth of Islamic investment in fund of funds. Fund of funds are very attractive. If you have an individual fund, then the Islamic investor has to mine down to a greater degree and say, well, this hotel investment, does it have a bar, or are there other non-acceptable practices taking place? If that real estate fund is part of a fund of funds, a lot of the Sharia interpretation are prepared to say, as a whole, it gets washed out. So this is the point about purity, and I think fund of funds will certainly be the way ahead. So those are some of the topics, some of the issues. There are many of you here who know much more about this, and I welcome your comments and questions later. Thank you.
I read this morning's guest list with some degree of trepidation, because there are far more people in this room who know more about Islamic banking than I do. So being a prudent banker, some of those still exist, I immediately contacted my legal counsel, who said, well, pontificate all you want, but make sure you get a disclaimer out there first. So I will read out my fine print that you find on the bottom of all the flyers you get from banks soliciting your business, to say that my views this morning are very much personal views. They don't represent either of the organizations with which I'm associated, and I am by no means an Islamic finance expert, let alone a Sharia scholar, but only really a part-time, non-executive participant. So I'm probably just an informed and perhaps not fully informed observer of the Islamic banking scene over the last 25 years or so. I first came across Islamic banking in 1984 when I was working as the head of the Asian operations of Gulf International Bank in Bahrain. The treasurer of the bank came to me and said, he's got these funny things with an unpronounceable name, which I later learned was Marabaha, that he didn't know what to do with because he couldn't redeploy them in the conventional interest-bearing market. Was there something we could try and do? So I immediately again consulted my legal counsel, and we struggled with documentation for a very long time, and eventually something emerged that would marry the Islamic investor with, in fact, a major Japanese trading company through the mechanism of a commodity buy and sell of a Singapore-based commodity broker. And we initially did a $10 million transaction with Mitsui & Co. on a Marabaha structure that satisfied everyone. The Islamic investor received a Sharia-compliant return. The commodity broker got his commission on the buy and sell. The Japanese trading company got a new source of funding at a relatively attractive rate. And being a good banker, we made something on the way through. That modest beginning for me over the next 6 months developed into $250 million of outstandings with Japanese trading companies. All of it Sharia compliant. Of course, in today's market, that structure is probably unacceptable. The documentation is certainly deficient. But at the time, it was very much a win-win for everyone. From those kinds of beginnings in the 80s, the Islamic finance market in the Gulf developed as a pool of liquidity grew, which was seeking Sharia-compliant investments. And over the next 20 years, you can pick a number, but a very significant volume of activity arose. Some of it in what I would call Islamic conventional financing using Marabaha or Musharaka. But increasingly, the market bifurcated. It developed a retail, high street banking arm, which offered a complex and growing sophisticated product suite involving personal credit, housing, car loans, credit cards, etc. And in various locations in the Gulf, in Bahrain, in Doha, in the Emirates, those retail operations have grown in profitability over the years. The other arm that developed in parallel was really the wholesale investment banking model, which was often driven by a private equity dynamic, i.e., the bank would go and acquire what it perceived to be an undervalued company, unlisted, and then place that investment with a group of Islamic investors. And after adding value through the management process, would then exit that investment through an IPO or a trade sale and generate significant, often significant value for the Islamic investors. And that co-investment mechanism was entirely Sharia compliant. I think one of the pioneers in this area in the Islamic sphere was First Islamic Investment Bank, now known as Arcapita. And that model enabled them to do a number of transactions very successfully. What's interesting of some of those transactions that were done in the late 90s and the early part of the noughties was that, in fact, they were leveraged. You often hear that Islamic transactions cannot be leveraged. Well, some of those private equity transactions were, in fact, leveraged in a Sharia-compliant manner, often using a leasing structure, ijara. The other sphere that Islamic banks ventured into from an early stage was project finance. And again, the leasing structure was very appropriate to achieve that, followed later by the growth of an Islamic bond market, the sukuk market, which Ian was mentioning. The market went along merrily until the bottom fell out and the credit crisis arrived. And contrary to expectation, Islamic institutions proved not to be immune from the crisis. And over the next 2 years, significant stresses arose in Gulf institutions, principally in the wholesale investment area, but the retail market was not entirely immune either. And although there had been underlying issues from the inception of this market, I think the credit crisis highlighted some basic structural issues which continue to dominate the struggle that Islamic banks are having to maintain or to keep profitability. The first, and I think the most major one, is a liquidity issue. And it really revolves around the classic Northern Rock type dilemma. That is, funding short and investing long. With the closure of exit for investments in many assets in the Islamic sphere, whether they're private equity or real estate, Islamic investment banks found themselves forced into a refinancing mode at the worst possible time. And it wasn't really a question of at what price can you refinance, it's can you refinance at all. There simply was no availability as people's credit risk horizons contracted. Coupled with liquidity, you have, through its very nature of investing in real assets, a heavy concentration in real estate and in the private equity sphere, both of which tend to be long-term and do not recycle themselves easily into liquid assets. This emerged both in the retail sphere through the property ownership financings that had been undertaken for a Gulf property market that was, in fact, a bubble, and in the investment area, where investment banks had not placed the entire amount of the investment back with Islamic investors, but indeed had kept sometimes a significant portion on their own books as proprietary investment, which needed refinancing. There were simply no exits available. This was coupled, of course, with an absolute decline in the value of the underlying assets. And one wonders whether this problem is yet past, whether there indeed could be more to come in terms of diminution of asset values. One of the structural issues that will, I think, come more and more to the fore over the next 1 or 2 years is legal testing of the underlying documentation supporting Islamic transactions. We have not really had court-tested examination of some of these structures. And we now have sukuks, and other Islamic structures in default. So it will be very interesting to see how that plays out. And I don't think it's always going to play out in the bankers' favor. Ian has touched on the issue of corporate governance and transparency. I think this is quite a significant structural problem in Islamic banks. And I couple that with inherent conflicts of interest of some investors within banks and for their own book whose pocket is being filled, together with a very large issue on the valuation of assets held in the balance sheets of Islamic banks. As the chair of the audit committee of European Islamic here in the UK, I'm very conscious of the need to satisfy my external auditors about the valuation that we carry of various assets. I'm not sure that everyone in the Gulf is working on the same playing field we are, and that even some of the large audit firms are not necessarily even-handed in their application of the appropriate rules. I think one of the concerns, as the difficulties have arisen in Islamic finance, is that we have untested management. We've had lots of management that have done very well riding the boom. It will be interesting how they work out, because most of them have little experience of riding the bust, if I can put it that way. And underlying a lot of the transactions, I have a nagging question of whether they are truly Islamic, or are they simply, in many cases, conventional transactions which have been forced into an apparently Sharia-compliant structural and documentary framework through the devices of clever bankers and lawyers? Do we have a question here, in many cases, of form over substance? I'm very confident, given the weight of money looking for Sharia-compliant investment, that the industry will survive. There is certainly a commercially viable opportunity to intermediate this money with assets not only in the Gulf, but clearly in Europe and North America and the Far East. This will be done, however, not without considerable volatility in the industry, and we will have failures along the way. And I would predict that we will see over the next several years perhaps the disappearance or merger of some Islamic finance institutions. Let me just finish my remarks by making a few comments about the UK experience of Islamic financial institutions. 4 or 5 years ago, as the existing institutions were going through the regulatory hurdle process to become licensed, the environment was relatively benign, both politically, which was very welcoming and supportive, as well as the business environment. There were few signs that we would face the crisis that we have faced. Therefore, we did have a number of institutions in the retail sphere, in the commercial, investment banking, as well as insurance, licensed in the UK. And these institutions adopted, quite rightly, different approaches to their marketplace and different product suites to attempt to intermediate this flow of which I've spoken. It's very early days in the life of a bank, 4 or 5 years. But I think it's fair to say that the road has proven much more difficult than certainly was set out in the regulatory business plans that were submitted to the FSA for everyone. And with very few exceptions, the cost base has been higher. The cost of market penetration has been higher. It has been more difficult to generate appropriate assets than was first envisaged. certainly at a level of profitability which justified the commercial viability of these institutions. As the crisis came along, the market was particularly hard hit. Credit losses emerged. There were decline in investment values. Losses were declared. And I think it's fair to say that many institutions are now looking to change the model that they first adopted. They are trying to revalidate that there is indeed a commercially viable opportunity in the UK. I'll leave it there, and I would certainly welcome any comments or thoughts that people have on the market, and if they can give us some clues as to really how to make money at this, we'd be very grateful. Thank you.
Of course, this is an academic-led seminar, so we'll have to put that advice in context. Thank you both very much for a very excellent and comprehensive overview. I mean, I find it very instructive and it raises a lot of questions.